Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC Radio and Cromwell Savings Bank. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio collector historian Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, our guest tonight is not only one of the biggest names in radio, but one of the greatest names in show business as well.
He certainly is, Dick. In fact, I can't think of any name that's any bigger than our guest tonight. He really ruled the era from around 1938 through World War II and thereafter for some years as well.
We're talking, of course, about Edgar Bergen, and I'm anxious to know how we were able to get this recording because it was done in Hollywood and it was done by you.
Yes, I took my vacation out there this year, Dick, and I thought it would be easy because in New York, if you want to find somebody, you look up in the phone book and there they are, but it's not that way in Hollywood at all. And we did have Carol on the show, you remember, a long time ago, and he was the writer for this show, and I called him and I got his phone number, and then I found, I talked to his secretary and we arranged for the interview. And it's very strange because he's on Sunset Boulevard, and that's where his office is, but there's no number on the door, no name, no mailbox. It's purely, really incognito to the nth degree. And you could walk by for 10 years and never know anybody was even in the building. So it was very strange from that standpoint. But it was a suite of offices and right on Sunset, right downtown Hollywood.
Now, can you tell us something about the office?
Well, there were... He had his own motion picture projection booth, and he had an awful lot of memorabilia. He had Charlie McCarthy dolls and radios and little spoons and bowls and premiums. He had a whole case full of these things and, of course, many, many photographs of people he worked with through the years. And all in all, very nice surroundings and very appropriate to the type of work he was doing.
Was he receptive to you and to the idea of doing a program on his life, his career?
Yes, because just recently, when we were out there, I guess, I thought he had retired, and he wanted to prove that he didn't, and he was very graceful in giving us this interview, particularly when I mentioned WTIC, because he knew the station quite well.
Well, of course, that program was on WTIC many years ago. Ed, I'm anxious to meet Edgar Bergen.
Well, Dick, it's my pleasure to present to you Mr. Edgar Bergen.
Well, thank you, Ed. It's always nice to say hello to radio friends, because that's the... I got some pretty loyal friends there across the country that were very nice to me through the years. And I'm awfully glad to have you come up to my office here. And by the way, that's Charlie's desk over there. As you see, he's got his own name there and Top Banana. That's his own idea, Billy.
Yeah, I was hoping Charlie might be around with us today. Maybe he might stop in and pay us a visit while we're talking, perhaps.
Yes, he's next door visiting a secretary.
He hasn't given up the wandering eye, has he?
No, he still is unruly. I spent all week getting him into trouble, and then I have to figure out a way to punish him to get him out of trouble. So.
Well, you had such a fabulous career. I'd like to go back to the early days and then perhaps maybe ask you about some of these rumors I've heard about you, some of the things that have happened in your career.
They're all true.
They're all good. But I guess your first exposure to using the art of ventriloquism was in the vaudeville circuit prior to your radio days. Is that right, Edgar?
Well, yes, my first experience was in high school, answering roll calls for missing classmates. And then they discovered that, and then I got blamed for everything. of course, I got Charlie in my senior year in high school, and I wouldn't have graduated from high school without Charlie, so I owe him a great deal.
Well, he helped you on all the exams, huh?
Yes. Well, no, my history teacher told me not to plan on graduating because I was so bad in medieval and modern history. Well, I was already booked for a show that summer, so I couldn't wait to get going, so a diploma wasn't very important. But then I went on a student recital after I got Charlie in about March, and I heckled all the teachers, And my history teacher, her name was Miss Angel Chises, so I got Miss Angel for history. He said, don't let the name fool you. She grows horns at examination time. Then we picked on the principal, too, and so she kept me after class the next day and said, she didn't know I had this talent, and the world needs laughter more than it needs another history teacher. She would help me graduate, so...
Was this the original Charlie that you had all through the years? It was made at that time, or do you have it redone later?
That is one of the most often asked questions, that, and can anyone be a ventriloquist? The answer to your question about Charlie, that was the original Charlie, and I still have him, and I don't use him as much now, because... I have made a lighter one out of fiberglass and has an acrylic paints and things, and it's a smoother, finer workmanship for pictures, you know. But Charlie still comes out, and then I trade them off. They each go in for a new makeup each fall for each season, so they get a little scratched and things like that. But I was a long time getting. I had three or four. I never did get one in. Carved out of wood to copy Charlie, but when we got rubber molds and plastics, then we could do it.
Yeah, did anybody ever say they felt they knew somebody who looked like Charlie, or he was such a unique looking individual, shall we say?
I copied him from a little Irish newsboy in front of the high school building, and he was a real Mick, you know, cocky little funny, and I used to kid with him, and so I guess there are Irishmen that look like him. But Mortimer Snerd, I have people say they know somebody who sounds and looks like Mortimer Snerd, so that's not quite as good a compliment, I guess.
Well, were you the first of the big-time ventriloquist in vaudeville at that particular time, Edgar?
Well, no. We never had more than four or five ventriloquists in the country, even in vaudeville days. But there was the great Lester, and he was a great ventriloquist, and then there was... chap named Valentine Vox, and then we'd have a fellow from Spain, Senior Wences, who's still around, and he's very good. But I just happened to get on radio and be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, could you tell us, just, I'm sure that this is another question you've been asked a thousand times, but what was the opening sesame that got you on the Rudy Valley Show?
Well, they booked Elsa Maxwell on the Rudy Valley Show, and she throws the party for the 400 at the Waldorf, and she has usually a celebrity, and then the who's who people, the 400, you know. And this time it was Noel Coward, and she hired me to come there and kind of heckle him and poke a little fun at the guest of honor rather than say all sweet things about him. Well, and she has another trick, and she puts the dull people together and the smart people together, and that way they all feel smart, you know, it balances up. So I was booked, and I ribbed with Charlie and poked fun at Noel, and he was a good audience. We had lots of fun. And so when they booked her on the Rudy Valley Show, how to give a party for important people. And then they said she has a ventriloquist heckle the guest that she did this. So that got the idea, why not bring him on? Well, I was playing the Rainbow Room in the Rockefeller Center.
Center, yes.
And so it just worked out fine. But when they told the agency and the sponsor they'd booked a ventriloquist on, they said, a ventriloquist on radio? Well, he damn well better be funny.
And he was.
And they were there to see that I was funny.
Well, that's one of the rumors I've heard, that when you first went on radio, you used your nightclub act, and then you said to them, I have no more. I'm all tapped out. And where do I go from here? How am I ever going to repeat? This is an act that took me years to polish. And, how am I going to continue? And how did that work out that you were able to continue?
Well, it was very amusing. And this first appearance was next to the last week or something in December of 36. So they said, well, I think I got $200 or $300 for going on the show. I asked for $300 and I got $200 or $250. I think that's what it was, yes. And then I said, well, if I go on next week, I'll certainly have to have more money. You know, I'll have to have $350 because I'm using up my material, you know. And so they said, well, I talked over, they I got $300. That went, so they said, well, let's do it one more week. I said, well, I have to have more money. So I'm using up all my material. And So I don't know. Then I got $350 or something. Then they says, let's round it out. How would you like to make it? So you've done three shows, and then we'll make it a total of 13 weeks altogether. Now, how's that? And I said, oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. Having no idea, but I panicked where I would get the material. I wrote all my own acts, but I'd been doing some one-reelers for Warner Brothers Studio in New York there, and they call them Vitaphone Shorts. And so I had some of those scripts that I could steal a little from, but the great lesson I learned from that was you never know what you're capable of doing until you have a deadline. And I had a 13 to 11 week deadline there, or 10 week deadline. And then I found that I could write and produce it and turn it out. I used to take a month or two to play a vaudeville act out of town before I'd bring it to New York. Here I wrote a vaudeville act every week.
It's a delightful experience to hear his recollections, isn't it?
It sure is, Dick. I really enjoyed every minute of it.
Get growing, get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
It's time to spring back into shape with a home improvement loan from Cromwell Savings Bank. Spring is here, and the green trees and warm weather aren't too far behind. Warm weather is an excellent time to remodel your home, and Cromwell Savings Bank has the greenbacks to finance your home improvement. You have the green light, so go ahead and repair the roof or revamp the rec room with a home improvement loan from your friends at Cromwell Savings Bank. Cromwell.
Grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member of FDIC, an equal housing lender, is located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
You know, it's about time, I think, that we hear an excerpt from the program.
Well, let's go back to one of those golden years on New Year's Eve and see what happened on the Edgar Berg and Charlie McCarthy show.
Charlie, do you realize that tonight's performance may alter the whole course of my life? And I've written a wonderful part for you.
Yeah?
You play Little New Year of 1945.
I do?
That's right.
Yes. I'm sort of a juvenile lead.
That's right, yes. You come out wearing a ribbon across your chest that says 1945.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Won't that be kind of drafty?
No.
What else do I wear?
I hope. Yeah. Well, what do babies usually wear?
Well,
Oh, no. Oh, no.
You mean with a safety pin?
Well, of course.
Oh, no, you don't. Listen, no, Charlie. No, a thousand times nay.
Charlie, no, listen.
Take your hands off.
All right.
You don't get me wearing one of those three-cornered snuggies.
Now, Charlie. Just, no. Charlie, what do you think I am, Gypsy Rose McCarthy?
All right.
Listen, Charlie, it's too late now. I can't get anyone else to play the part.
Mr. Bergen, Charlie.
No, Charlie.
No.
All right.
Do you realize what you're asking me to do?
Yes.
Do you realize?
All right.
Do you realize what you're doing to a child of my tender years?
Yes, yes, but not be reasonable.
No, I won't be reasonable.
Charlie. Charlie.
Let go of my lap.
Charlie.
No,
this is very important to me.
I will not appear in public wearing nothing but my goose pimples.
No. Charlie.
No, no.
You look cute.
No, I wouldn't. My legs are so sway-backed.
Oh, they're not. Why, you'll make a splendid 1945.
No, I won't.
Yes, you will.
I'm so puny.
You're not.
Everybody will think there's a tough year ahead.
No. Ah, you're so sensitive.
Well, I have reasons to be.
Why?
No, certain other things.
What is it?
Well, it's nice. No, I got a mole on my tummy.
Oh! Yeah. But, Charlie, everything depends on you.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm in a spot, Charlie.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh, you're in a spot.
You'll, of course. Why, I'll do anything if you'll agree to play this part.
You will?
Yes.
Well, now you said something, yes. That's all I want to know, Bergen.
Yes. Then you will play it?
On what condition?
All right.
First, you got to cancel all those New Year's resolutions you just made out for me.
Yes. But, Charlie...
And second, Now that you'll sign all my report cards in the future with your eyes closed.
Yeah, but Charlie...
And, of course, my 75 cents allowance...
Yes?
...will come up for renegotiation.
Is that right?
Oh, just delightful to hear. And that was the voice of Don Ameche.
Yes, who was a guest not too long ago on the show. In fact, a lot of the material, the questions I asked were because of the interview with him, because we talked so much about his experiences on the Bergen Show.
There have been a number of philanthropic ventures in which Edgar Bergen has been involved.
Yeah, like Jack Benny, I guess he has a reputation for being rather tight with the dollar, but he really isn't. He has many charities, and one of the most... his pet charity, if you want to call it that, would be the Bergen Foundation, where he actually supports student nurses to help them through their studies. And there were some, he has a big chart on the wall, and there were a few from Connecticut, one from Waterbury, one from Hartford, so it's even gotten to this part of the country again. I guess over 500 nurses went through the program, by the way.
We left off in your interview with Edgar Bergen at the point where he was still appearing on Rudy Valley's show, and I'd like to continue with that story now.
Well, as I recall, after that, he went to the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and I asked him if there was much of a transition to go from the guest shot into his own show.
Well... I was so busy writing, I had to do a spot, two spots then, one with a guest and one with Charlie alone. And then we got the problem of involving Ray Noble and Don Ameche and Nelson Eddy, Dorothy L'Amour. So, I had an agency man and a secretary, so we would write, and we would write all week. And then finally, as the work increased, I was able to build a staff, but you had to just try out people who thought they could write, and I had a test sheet with employment agency, a situation in one paragraph, and then Bergen says, Charlie says, and a joke, and I didn't want any continuity. I just wanted jokes on that subject. That was a good way to get around padding and a lot of straight talk, you see. But each one had to have a joke. And it just developed, and I was very conscientious about it. I worked 7 days a week on it for a long time.
Yes, and you worked before a live audience, and I often wondered, was there a great deal of anxiety before you went on the air that the material would be funny, that you would get the laughs, because there's nothing worse, I guess, than having your material out there and then people aren't responding. Did you ever have that kind of anxiety when you went on?
I tell you, nothing is so nice and as easy as success, you know. And if you're hot and popular at the time, and I was just blossoming then, just starting, so yeah, I could do no wrong, and it was easy. But I was very concerned that it was written right, and we would rewrite on. We'd have a rehearsal on Saturday, and then rewrite and tighten it, and then have another rehearsal on Sunday with corrections. And what amused me was when these picture name stars, you know, who I have admired from a distance in films, you know, would ask me how they should read their lines, if I would read their lines for them. Well, it was quite a shock when, some of these, our beautiful girls and our very talented stars, but I understood later on because that's a director's job on a film, and a good performer, a picture actor, he comes more or less as putty and lets the director mold him, or her, into the way they want them in the picture, because they are different characters in different pictures. But I was, and then I had my little line when sometimes they'd be quite nervous, because talking clear across the country, you know, and if you make a mistake, you can ruin your career by saying the wrong thing, like cussing or something, which has happened, you know. And what amused me was that they'd be nervous, some of them, and my line was, I hope you're a little nervous, because I find every performer gives a better performance if they sparkle it a little more if they're nervous. Well, it was a kind of a hypnosis. But it's true, though, and I don't like to see a performer go on completely relaxed. I think it helps to perform, but of course it's got to be in moderation.
Yeah, I guess once you do go on the air, the tension eases anyway. I think it's just that waiting for that second hand to come around where they give you the red light. I wonder if you could just paraphrase for us some of the funny lines you remember between Charlie and some of your very famous guests. Would that be possible for you to do, Edgar?
Well, of course, the one they will always ask for is W.C. Fields, and he will say, "Charles, is it true that your father was a gate-leg table?" And Charlie would say, "If it is, your father was under it." Yeah. Then one says, "I've never hated a kid so much since the day I was born." Charlie says, "You weren't born, Mr. Fields. You were squeezed out of a bar rag." And he says, "If you were sawdust on the barroom floor, Charles, I would walk 8 blocks for a chocolate soda." And it went on and on. He says, "I'll split you down the middle and use you for skis." "I'll throw a termite on you." And all that sort of thing.
Yes. How about the female guest? I guess the most famous, the one that everybody remembers, was Mae West. That was quite an incident because you almost went off the air because of that.
Yes, and the network had to apologize, and the sponsor apologized, and it was all pretty much innocent. But if Mae West says, "Hello, how are you?" Well, it's sex. So at rehearsal, it was just cute and silly. There were several that got us into trouble, such as, she says, "Why don't you come up and see me sometime, Charlie?" Charlie says, "In what do?" And she says, "Oh, I'll let you play in my woodpile." "Well, that's all right, but when you start, come up and see me, I'll let you..."
Can we misinterpret it?
Everything, if she's, "How are you feeling?" Right away you think of the bedroom. But she's a great performer. And I went in hiding after that broadcast, and the net result of it all was my rating went up 2 points.
And she was banned for life, wasn't she, from the airwaves? That's what I understand happened anyway.
Well,
very drastic action at that time.
I could hardly believe that would be true, but... she was a clever woman. I just heard her here about a year ago at the university. They honored her there, and she wrote most of her plays and her films. And when she was interviewed, when she talked, she said something. She thought she was all right.
Well, Don Ameche said, and paraphrasing him, that you're a very, very shy individual.
Yeah.
And you go to parties, you sit in a corner, and you just kind of keep to yourself. But yeah. When you bring Charlie out, then everything seems to change. Yeah. Is that right? That's your other personality?
I wish I could go into a room and be accepted as completely as Charlie is, you know. But I guess some comedians have to work with a cigar and a hat, and Chaplin had to have his funny old shoes on. I guess Charlie is my crutch. And, they say a man is known by the company he keeps, and I've kept company the last 40 years with a dummy. But it's paid off.
Yes, handsomely, I suspect. Of course, when people, when Charlie insults them, and that was part of the humor, they get mad at him. Did they ever get mad at you? Or they always think it was him, and they even disassociated the two people there, or the two personalities.
No, isn't it funny? As a matter of fact, the exact opposite happened when I had Irene Dunne on, and I got to say the nice things because she lives across the street from me, and we're neighbors. But she and I introduced her as the first lady of the films and of Hollywood, you know, because she played such beautiful parts. And so she complained after a rehearsal. She says, "Well, Charlie has taken cracks at everybody, and he never insulted me once." I says, "Well, that's easily fixed." So we wrote something in. And so they didn't complain. I remember we had Clark Gable on. Clark Gable didn't want to appear with Charlie. He was a little reluctant. He didn't want to talk to a dummy, you know. But he agreed to do it, you know. So he came on, and was the audience, of course, were electrified. There was Clark Gable. And so Charlie says, "So you're Clark Gable?" He says, "Yes." He says, "And you're Charlie McCarthy?" I said, yeah. Then he, they both laughed then, you know. He says, well, Mr. Gable, I think this town can be big enough for both of us. We'll make an agreement. I'll promise not to wear a turtleneck sweater if you won't wear a monocle. So we talk, and then they exchange secrets on how to win the girls over. He wined them and dined them. And Charlie had his ideas. Oh, they're going to exchange. And Charlie says, well, I'll tell you what I know. You tell me what you know about with the winning the girls. He said, of course, you understand I'm giving more than I'm getting, you know. So then Dorothy L'Amour comes in, and Clark asks her for a date, and she turns him down. She says, I'm sorry, I can't go out with you tonight. Charlie says, ha, 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 putty, putty, putty. And then he says, Dorothy, dear, I'm the boy. How about, do we have a date tonight? She says, no, I can't go out with you. He says, you mean I'm turned down? He says, well, who can be this great man? What a charm. Who can be better than what we have here? So she says, I'm going out with Edgar. And he says, oh, no. Which was, that put me down pretty low, I guess, in their opinion. But it was great experience, we talk about the golden days of radio. I say these are the golden days of radio because there are more people listening today than in the golden days of radio because we have pocket radios. And I was thinking the other day, my gardener, when he's trimming rose bushes, right, he's got a pocket radio going. And my wife has a Mexican seamstress. She comes in, she has a Mexican station on all day long when she's sewing there. And my bookkeeper, she has a little background music in her office there. So people can work and drive and enjoy radio programs. I do think if I had any criticism to make that the sponsors should be aware of their big market, and I wish it wouldn't always be one record and then one commercial that is louder than the rest of the show.
He's marvelous. Just marvelous. You can go on with him all night long, I'm sure. Who assisted you in getting this recording, by the way, Ed?
Well, a good friend of mine who I tape with out there, Lloyd Nisbet, who is a tape recorder repair specialist, and that's why the recording is so good, because we use first-class equipment. So I was very, very grateful, because we couldn't have done it without him, Dick.
No, I'm sure that's the case. I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to the Golden Age of Radio from WTIC in Hartford.
Get growing, get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Spring is here and time for home improvements. And home improvement time is any time you see Cromwell Savings about a home improvement loan. Cromwell Savings Bank is one friend you can borrow from. So mend your fences, add a room, redecorate the downstairs, repair the roof, or whatever else your home needs, with the helping hand of a home improvement loan from Cromwell Savings. Get growing now at Cromwell Savings Bank.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member of FDIC, an equal housing lender, is located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
This is Dick Bertel along with Ed Corcoran, and I think it's about time we heard more from Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy in that wonderful show of theirs.
Well, this time we'll have a little word from Mortimer Snurd, one of the other very famous characters that was created by Mr. Bergen.
How did you like Washington, D.C.?
Well, I'll tell you. I've been to a lot of places, I'll tell you, and I can truthfully say that, yes, sir, I can truthfully say that Washington, D.C. is one of them.
Do you know, Mortimer, do you know who was the first president of the United States?
Well, you see, I... Oh, well, yeah, there was, could you give me a little clue on that?
The first president was George.
Yeah. Well, the one we got now is real George, too.
Yes. Now, who was our first president?
Well, let me think now. Let's see. The first president again.
You think real hard.
Hope I didn't bust anything. Yeah.
I'll give you another clue. The city of Washington, D.C. was named after him.
Is that so? Yes. Anybody we know?
Yes. Surely you know our first president.
No.
Well, and the things he did. What happened in 1773?
Would you give me that again?
Yes. What happened in 1776?
Maybe I should move over and make room for both of us up here.
I repeat, what happened in 1776?
Was it the War of 1812? No.
Your memory is certainly poor.
Poor but proud.
Yeah. Our first president was George Washington. Certainly you've heard of George Washington.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, yeah. He's the fellow who threw the cherry tree across the Tomaine River. No.
Almost right, Mortimer, but not quite.
Hello, everybody.
Well, what excuse have you got for being so late?
Well, I tell you, this time I'm so pooped I can't invent one. Oh, I... you see, Bergen, you're making my pants too long. I'm so glad to see all of you wonderful people. You know, I could just kiss every one of you.
Well, now that's a nice thought, Charlie.
Yes, it is. All single girls line up in the aisle. hurry, get them while they last.
Hey, Charlie, must it always be girls?
Well, I don't suppose so, no.
Don't you like me just a little?
Well, of course I do, Bergen. How silly, of course. I love every hair on your head. I know that's not much, but that's the way I feel.
Well, I'm glad to see you with such a sunny disposition.
Yes, I can't say anything bad about anybody. I love everybody. I could kiss every single person on the show.
I say, hello, you chap.
All single girls back in the aisle again.
Charlie, now, please.
I forgot myself. Ray, old pal.
Yes.
Do you mind if I say you're my favorite orchestra leader?
Well, not at all, old boy. I often say the same thing myself, you know. why this sudden flattery?
Well, Ray, you're seeing the good side of Charlie.
Really?
Yes. Yes, there is one, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he's not always bad. You see, Charlie has a split personality.
I knew it. When I bent over yesterday, I heard it rip. Rip.
No. An individual with a split personality is one who vacillates from positive to a disparaging attitude surreptitiously. Down, boy, down. Now, unscrew that and give it to me in sections. Well, it's very simple. All it means, Charlie, is that you are two different people.
Well, congratulations, Charles, old boy.
Thank you.
I do hope you'll be very happy together. I said it came right out of my head.
It did, didn't it? Now, don't leave until they patch up the hole. All right.
Please, darling. There's no hole. I'll make one. No. Neither of you seem to understand. Perhaps I can explain.
Yes, I can explain by telling you a story.
Yeah?
Yes.
I will. Oh, we are in luck, aren't we?
All right. Yes, this is the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, Dr. Jekyll lived several centuries ago.
Your personal physician?
No. One night, Dr. Jekyll mixed a strange brew of powerful chemicals. And when Dr. Jekyll drank this mysterious potion, he became the monstrous Mr. Hyde. He forgot his lovely sweetheart and chased every girl he saw.
Gad! I wonder if I'm taking that stuff and don't know it.
All right. One day, while under the influence of this drug, an old man walked up to him and merely said, "Hello." And Mr. Hyde beat him to death.
Well, that ought to teach him not to speak to strangers.
Of course, killing this man made Mr. Hyde a murderer.
Yeah. Oh, it'll do it every time.
Now, one time, the terrible Mr. Hyde stalked into a house where a beautiful girl lived all alone.
Yeah? What's the address?
No, please. The girl suspected he meant to murder her. He walked toward her, his long, hairy arms outstretched.
his fingers groping for her throat.
Now, Bergen, save the gestures for television. And then think of something to say to television.
There, she said, I've got you, and I'm going to kill you. And she said, no, no, don't kill me. I'm going to kill you. Please don't.
Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful how you can change your voice.
Thank you.
I swear it was two people.
The poor girl kept pleading, don't kill me. Don't kill me. Don't kill me.
I'll go on, kill her.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, if she can't act any better than that, she deserves to die.
All right.
There's something that he's not.
Tremendous, tremendous.
They never seem to grow old.
Well, you know, you're talking in the plural, and really, Edgar and Charlie are alter egos. I'm convinced of it.
Yeah, well, what do you think of, you know, you're an old fan of his. How do you feel listening to this and hearing him, you know, what he's really like, this Edgar Bergen?
First of all, I think he's a genius of comedy, and I think his ability to move from the one character into the other with such agility makes him a great performer, one of the greatest performers I think that radio ever developed.
Certainly the greatest comic, and you say, and all these ad-libs that he threw at you, too, they weren't written. He did say that those, they just developed during
the
show.
I'm sure they did, like the mistake on 1776 when he said 1773. Perfect example of marvelous recovery. Well, when you were talking with Edgar, you somehow brought up another program, War of the Worlds.
Yes, you know, the War of the Worlds was opposite this. That's the Orson Welles War of the Worlds. It was opposite this on CBS, and this was on NBC. And a lot of people switched dials and everything. And I asked him whether, you know, he felt he was to blame for the panic that ensued.
Well, I couldn't very well do anything about that.
Not directly, but I mean, your show, there must have been a break in there where normally switched over.
Oh, they switched back and forth. Well, I got the nicest compliment from the New York Times when they wrote it up and saying that New Jersey was all shook up over the thing. And he says, well, anybody stupid enough not to be listening to Charlie McCarthy would be apt to believe there were Martians invading, which was really a great compliment. And
well, they started, and I guess there was an orchestra break or something, and they foolishly switched dials, and then they got right in the middle of the other thing, and then the whole thing. So indirectly, I guess, your show was responsible. You were saying that you had a lot of firsts on your show?
Yeah, we have quite a few firsts there. For example, in the early days, we were the first show to broadcast from outside the United States. We broadcast from Mexico City. Then, of course, we had line trouble, and we had to get the hotline from the ambassador, American embassy there, and the show came over that line. Then I was the first one to broadcast from a military base, March Field, out here. I was flying my own plane, and I had a little Stinson 105 and flew in there. And they gave me a military escort, and it was hot stuff. And then I got one of the most unusual ones. I guess I'm the only ventriloquist. I have appeared in three leper colonies. You know, I don't know how it happens, but I was in one in Hawaii, which was a very touching thing. I took my whole show out playing at the Royal Hawaiian there and took the show over. And then when we were finished, they all stood up and sang a Hawaiian song, a thank you song. Well, it just was so beautiful. It was just about wrecked us. Then there was, of course, there was one in New Orleans, and there was one down in Venezuela where I appeared once. And then, let's see, I was the first performer to appear in Berlin after the war. I flew in on the coal lift, and you might call that made the Black Bottom popular. Where we used cigarettes for money there, two cigarettes for a big husky German boy carrying my suitcases up to the room and things like that.
Yeah, chocolate bars were pretty valuable there, too.
Yes, yeah. And also, if a woman could get a job cooking for an officer, and then she could carry home the grounds after the one boiling, yeah, that was, and some fat, would be very good. When it got into television, I was the first one to do a television show in a studio with a live audience, and the first one to first television show to be seen from coast to coast on the same day. That was before the cable. At 8 o'clock New York, 8 o'clock Chicago time, 8 o'clock West Coast time. We made about 85 prints of film, you see. And
you circulated all over the country, but it was simultaneously broadcast in all three states.
And the biggest job was to keep telling the cameramen, you got to get it on the first take, because they ask, they'll do five and six takes. I did one take. Letter of introduction, the girl made 32 takes before the director was satisfied. I worked 2 days on a take in the film there, letter of introduction, where Charlie is running down, we run down three flights of stairs, and I'm carrying him, and then I let him slide from the third to the second floor, and then pick him up and run out of the building. We spent 2 days to make that one. It was a director's achievement, of course. And then they end up by intercutting it after all that.
It must be very exhausting to do something. I guess comedy, when you do it, always repeats. It must be hard to maintain the pace and everything that's required. It's such a delicate thing to get get laughs from people, and to do it in that manner must have been very difficult for you.
Well, the tragedy of what television is, where they hold up science to applaud and laugh. They sometimes have to do that, and they have to use laugh track. But I'm amazed that people are so smart to those things. And you don't mind it. It's all right, I guess. But for young people, I just came back from Alberta, Canada, at Edmonton there, and did a show there. Had 2,800 people in the theater. And there was a Scandinavian group, and they had the children and the acrobats and all hometown talent, singers and all. But they were good, and it was a big show. And it was such a thrill for those children to appear before a big audience and an orchestra, something they will remember all their life, and they'd rehearsed with their different stunts. And we need little theaters, and we don't need more microphones. Projection is something we mustn't forget. To just wrap up an audience with you. I saw Frank Sinatra's opening at Las Vegas here a couple of weeks ago. And it was just magic. It was just mass hypnosis, what he did with that audience. But it was a great piece of work.
I wonder if you could just tell us about how the other characters developed, Mortimer and Effie Clinker.
Well,
they came along a little bit later, didn't they, in your career?
Yes, I had Charlie for 10 years, and then I was doing nightclubs because vaudeville was dying. And then I got on radio and doing some clubs. I would bring Charlie out for encores, two or three times sometimes. And you're supposed to do something a little different, play a ukulele or something, but not more of the same thing. So there was nothing for me to do but get another character. And so I went over what I had in the way of voices. I didn't want anything that would come close to Charlie. So I had to go the other way, down low. So then it was Mortimer, and he talks a little bit like this, So that was a stupid voice, and so you had to have a stupid face. And I studied character analysis, and he's a combination of weak features. He's a low brow, a low-bridged nose. He's not aggressive. He has high arched eyebrows like a dreamer. He has a weak receding chin, no determination. He has buck teeth and is a little cross-eyed. I threw everything at him. But still, he has to be likable. Photographically, you must like his appearance. And I do like him. He's stupid, but he's honest. And he knows that he's stupid, and that almost makes him smart, you see. Smarter than some of us, anyway. Mortimer is scientifically stupid, and he's exactly what I want. That's more than a lot of parents can say about their children.
And how about Effie Clinker? That's even a later development, wasn't it?
Yes, she came a little later. I did. What about that? I had the voice first. I brought in two or three cartoonists, like a couple from Disney, and had another one that I knew, and I had him listen to the voice of Effie Clinker, and she's...
Well, now, my name is Effie Clinker.
Yes. You're not married, are you?
No, I'm not. No, damn it, no.
Are you thinking of marrying anyone?
Well, just about anyone, yes.
I see.
I was telling my daughter the other day...
Oh, your daughter. I thought you were an old maid.
Well, I'm not a fussy old maid.
I see. Well,
you never used us on the radio, did you, that
routine? No, not very much.
No. Well, Effie Clinker came along. That was a falsetto. And she is a busybody. She's a nosy person. And she has a sharp, long nose. And Oh, she has chickens in her backyard, and she has a... And she is a gossip, you know. She's, she's active in the women's club in the town, you know. And then some of the girls go over to a little cocktail lounge after the meeting, but they had to stop that because she says, what was wrong with it by that?
Well, some of the girls get a little too flowery.
Too flowery?
They get potted.
Oh, I see. Yes. And then they gave a little lawn party. You had a meeting at a home, and you had... Yes, it was very nice.
The garden was lit up, and, of course, I wasn't doing too bad myself.
That's right. That's the way she goes on.
Yes, she's delightful. Can we hear something with W.C. Fields? He was on the show for a long time.
Oh, yes, and not only W.C. Fields, but we have Don Amici in this excerpt, too, Dick.
Fine, fine, fine.
Pull yourself together.
Now. What is this sound I hear?
Bill, Bill.
Suffering from swollen thighs. Sitting down too much, I suppose. They made a mistake and bought me camphor balls instead.
Did you swallow them?
Yeah, and every time I sneeze, dozens of moths fly out.
What?
Yeah, a covey of moths closely followed by a bevy of silverfish.
A bevy?
Flying in V formation. Light fly on the wing.
Hey, Bill.
Here's a sign of
Bill, now look, wait a minute.
When the little
Bill, now look, hold everything. Please, Bill, let's cut out the poetry. Nobody wants to hear anything about moths.
Moth in the flame?
No.
Don't you remember Maeterlinck's poem about the moth?
Oh, now, Bill, Maeterlinck wrote about bluebirds.
Practically the same thing.
Yeah, I guess it is. Anyway, you shouldn't sleep with your mouth open.
I don't. I sleep with my mouth closed. They crawl in through the nostrils.
Well, that gives them more room. You do anything about it?
Yeah, I usually drink a couple of glasses of flip before retiring.
Does that kill the moth?
Doesn't help them any. I'm usually awake all night. There's one consolation, though. The moths suffer as much as I do. I feel them flying around in my stomach, screaming with pain.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Fields.
Oh, hello, Werner. Where's your orchestra?
No, that's Edgar Bergen.
Oh, yes, I know. Don't tell me. Hello, Edwin.
Edgar.
Don't prompt me. I know.
Mr. Fields, Charlie wants to say something to you.
Yes. Oh. Hello, Mr. Fields.
Hello, blood poison.
And now, do you feel sorry that you said I was full of termites?
I guess I do. I really haven't had time to give it much thought.
You know, Charlie really loves you, Mr. Fields.
Yes, I do. But I don't think Mr. Fields loves me.
Now, listen, that's gone far enough. I've been a gentleman up to now.
Why, what's the matter, Bill?
Well, he's not going to tell me I don't love him. I'll break every knot in his body.
Back to our guest right after this word from our sponsor.
Get growing. Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Perhaps this is the year you've decided to improve your home's exterior appearance. New plantings for the front yard, a new driveway, or that backyard patio you've always desired. Well, these two can be yours with a home improvement loan from the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank. Springtime is action time, so visit them soon. They're open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays, 9 to 5, and Fridays, 9 till 7:30 p.m.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member of FDIC, an equal housing lender, is located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
Well, let's get back to your conversation with Edgar Bergen in Hollywood. I'm anxious to know what he's planning.
Well, I had heard rumors that he was retiring, so I asked him about him, and he squelched them for us.
That was where a bad review helped me. It said I was retiring, and then the local high school here, Warren High School in Downey, they said, you can't retire. We've just gotten acquainted with Charlie in the last 5 and 8 years. So they had a Charlie McCarthy Day out there, Edgar Bergen Day, and the boys wore cardboard top hats and painted monocles on their face. And we had a parade, and I spoke to, I guess it was 5 50-minute classes, and I was completely husky when I got through. But it was, and I was so impressed with these young people that they gave me a standing ovation, and they just seemed to love the golden age of radio, and when we talked about the shows and things, so...
Well, I wonder, in signing off, whether you may have Charlie say goodnight to our audience for us, Edgar.
But it isn't night yet.
Why, it's sure it is, isn't it? In radio it is.
So good night, so good night.
Well, if you had it to do all over again, Charlie...
Well, I'll tell you, as I look back on the whole thing, it's a long story and a dirty one.
No. Well, we've enjoyed each other, and I'm afraid Charlie's got me right where I want him, or I've got him right where he wants me, something like that. But I may give him a raise. I've thought seriously about it. But I do think, Charlie, it would be nice...
What's that, Bergen?
After all I've done for you through the years, if you would change your name to Charlie Bergen.
Oh, no. That would be a black day for the Irish.
Yes, well...
Oh, the shamrock would droop its petals in shame.
Yes, that's so. Well, if you're so much in love with the shamrock, why did you forsake it?
Well, because I wanted to be in clover.
Well, all right. Trouble is with you, Charlie, you don't know the real truth about the Swedes.
Yes, I do. A Norwegian told me.
Oh, I see. All right. Well,
goodbye.
Well, I'll say goodbye, too.
And I'd like to say goodbye. And if there are any single fellas listening in, my phone number.
All right, all right. No commercial.
Oh, darn it. It happens every time. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Edgar.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC Radio and Cromwell Savings Bank. Join Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran again on Thursday, May 23rd, when the guest will be the noted radio and motion picture actor, Arnold Moss. The Hollywood portion of tonight's program was recorded by Lloyd Nesbitt, technical supervision by Bob Schirrego. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camel, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.